Tragically, this week, UPS had its first crash in the history of the airline. We lost a 747.
Two Anchorage-based pilots lose their lives in a UPS crash. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 6th of September, Labor Day. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a ski trip in the Wrangell Mountains that doesn't go as planned.
I feel like mountains have been giving us a lot of signs that say it's not the right time to be skiing here.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you smoke, odds are you want to quit. And if you want to quit, you're probably finding it tough to do. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. The average smoker tries 10 times before they quit for good. You can increase your chances by calling the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. Give it a shot. It's free and it works. Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
Federal investigators say the skies were clear and the weather was good when a cargo plane crashed last month at Denali National Park. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Weather didn't seem to be a factor in the August 1st fatal crash of the Fairchild C-123 at Denali National Park, that according to a preliminary report by the National Transportation Safety Board. The report posted last week on the NTSB website doesn't suggest a cause, and investigators aren't talking about the crash that killed three, including the pilot, Bill Michael, who owned the aircraft, and the Delta Junction-based air cargo company All West Freight. The NTSB report states that the weather was generally good, a light breeze was blowing, and that clouds may have been partially obscuring area mountains. According to the report, two eyewitnesses told investigators they saw the plane just before the crash. One, a certified pilot, says he believes the C-123's twin engines were working hard as it flew by, but otherwise he didn't see anything unusual. The C-123 was transporting a heavy generator from Palmer to a mining project near Unalakleet. Another witness, a private pilot, told investigators she saw the airplane flying straight and level and that it appeared to be in slow flight, but otherwise everything appeared normal. She said she saw the aircraft pitch straight up at one point to a near vertical position, then stall, then rolled left and nosedived toward the ground. The crash brought the total number of fatalities in general aviation accidents in Alaska so far this year to 14. That's twice as many as all of last year. That number does not include the four people who were aboard another aircraft that disappeared August 21st in southwest Alaska. Searches are ongoing for that plane, a de Havilland Beaver that vanished somewhere east of King Salmon. On Saturday, the parents of two of the missing passengers announced a $15,000 reward to anyone who finds the plane or its wreckage. If all of those passengers were killed, it would bring the total number of plane crash fatalities in Alaska so far this year to 18. That would be the highest number since 2003, when 19 people were killed in plane crashes statewide. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
In Anchorage, the Labor Day holiday was celebrated with a picnic put on by the AFL-CIO on the park strip. Union members and their families turned out under cloudy skies to share barbecue and give away hats and trinkets with the public. According to state AFL-CIO President Vince Beltrami, it's the first time organized labor has staged such an event in Alaska's largest city.
Every year in Fairbanks, actually for the last 3 years I've gone to Fairbanks because they have an annual Labor Day parade and picnic. And in Juneau, there's been an annual picnic going on for about 3 years. And this is the first, actually, the inaugural Labor Day picnic, I believe, in Anchorage.
Among the unions present were some that are not under the AFL-CIO umbrella, like the Independent Pilots Association, which represents the pilots that fly for the United Parcel Service. A number of them live in Anchorage. Over the weekend, they were stunned to learn that two of their number died in a plane crash on Friday. Brian Godet is a union spokesman.
Tragically, this week, UPS had its first crash in the history of the airline. We lost a 747 over in Dubai, and just want to make sure we mention, particularly on this Labor Day, you know, our hearts and thoughts and prayers go out to the families of our two fallen crew members, and you know, we're dedicating everything that we do to them.
Dubai is in the United Arab Emirates. Captain Doug Lampe, age 48, and First Officer Matthew Bell, age 38, were killed when their plane crashed shortly after takeoff from the airport there. UPS's Anchorage pilots tend to be younger and have less seniority than those who live elsewhere in the country. They are being strongly affected by furloughs the company has instituted to cut costs. UPS is under pressure from the state and from local governments, as well as Alaska's congressional delegation, to reconsider the cutbacks. Ketchikan's cruise ship industry is reporting mixed sales this summer. KRBD's Maria Dudzak spoke to some downtown merchants and tour operators about how sales have been going this season and has this report.
With approximately 140,000 fewer cruise ship passengers predicted for this summer, store owners and tour operators said they were expecting lower sales. Results, however, appear to be mixed for the 2010 season. Some businesses are reporting increases in sales, some say sales are down, and others say sales are comparable to last year. Don Bowman sells flight scene tours for Takwan Air and ground tours for the Alaska Rainforest Sanctuary. Bowman says despite the predictions, bookings have been very successful.
We actually have had an exceptional summer, and I think there's only a couple days that we weren't able to do a tour. And I think overall the tourism industry has done very well this summer.
Bowman says bear tours, zip line adventures, and sanctuary tours have all been full this summer. He says sales are as good as or better than last year. Bowman says flight seeing tours did exceptionally well. He says good weather and marketing strategies helped.
I think obviously the weather was good last year. I think it was even better this year. People came a little better prepared as far as spending money was concerned. The cost of the tours seemed to be a little more reasonable this year because we understood we need to make an adjustment because of the economy.
Bowman says Takwan was able to sell more seats on flight seeing tours by offering discounts to larger groups. Michael Ditton of Alaska Amphibious Tours says the duck tours are also doing well this summer.
We've actually had a wonderful season. We've experienced a bit of an increase off the ships, a bit of an increase off the docks, and a bit of an increase offline. So we've actually had a wonderful season so far.
Ditton says despite lower passenger counts, his company's overall sales increased this year from last year. He says an internet marketing campaign and a stronger presence on the dock may have helped contribute to increased sales. John Holt is owner of Seahorse Ventures, offering horse-drawn trolley tours. Holt says his tour consistently captures 5% of the cruise ship passenger market each season. He says lower passenger counts have affected sales.
It's been difficult. It's down from last year. Any time that we dip below 800,000 in cruise ship passengers, then it's a difficult season for us.
Holt says he anticipated a decrease in sales this year. He says he's operating one less trolley and cut back his workforce. Marvin Oliver, artist and co-owner of Eagle Arts Gallery on Creek Street, says sales in his gallery are up from last year, but most are buying smaller items such as cards and decorative aprons. Oliver says fine art is not selling well, but he is optimistic that things will change.
I think there's much more to fine art than it was a number of years ago. People purchase it because they really, really enjoy that and they have a good feeling for it. And it also reflects Alaska. You know, their trip to Alaska, they want something special on a higher scale, like a print. And I think that's where you see those sales come through. And I think that's going to be encouraging in the future.
Though fewer passengers came to Ketchikan this season, numbers are expected to increase slightly next year. Two Disney Cruise Line ships and the Crystal Symphony will begin sailing the Inside Passage in 2011. In Ketchikan, I'm Maria Dudzak.
Still to come on Alaskan News Nightly, a new list of Alaskan birds in trouble.
The idea is to try and keep an eye on them before they're in critical danger.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaskan News Nightly is brought to you in part by
NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
The Alaskan Independence Party has selected Michigan militia founder Norm Olson as its candidate for lieutenant governor. But AIP leaders say they're sticking with the party's candidate for governor, Don Wright, over Bill Walker, who lost to Governor Sean Parnell in the August 24th Republican Party primary election and has been looking for ways to continue his campaign. AIP Chairwoman Lynette Clark says Wright had been considering stepping down as the candidate, but told party leaders on Saturday that he planned to stay on the ballot for the November general election. Wright could not be immediately reached for comment. Olson, who lives on the Kenai Peninsula, says he is commander of a growing group called the Alaska Citizens Militia. The head of the United States Forest Service says the proposed transition to more forest restoration and second growth logging will not require a special amendment to the Tongass Land Management Plan. On his recent trip to Petersburg, Chief Tom Tidwell talked about the transition with KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein.
Under the current Tongass Land Management Plan, timber companies could be allowed to log as much as 267 million board feet of timber a year on the national forest, depending on market demand. When the latest revision of the plan was finalized in 2008, it prompted criticism from timber industry supporters who thought it was too restrictive for logging. Meanwhile, conservationists thought the environmental protections were not strong enough. That was under the Bush administration. This spring, under the Obama administration, the Forest Service announced it was going to transition away from cutting old-growth trees and instead focus on forest restoration projects and second-growth harvests. It's a major change in national forest policy, but U.S. Forest Service Chief Tom Tidwell does not think it necessitates a change to the management plan for the Tongass.
There's no need to amend the forest plan. Forest plans are a permissive document. They indicate what we consider to do. And so in this case, the 267 million board feet, it's something that we could consider harvesting that level. What we want to do with the transition is to shift our focus on sustaining communities.
Tidwell pointed to the decades of controversy over the Tongass timber program. He had nothing but praise for the work of Forest Service staff, but he noted that the forest's annual timber sale volume had dropped to an average of roughly 30 to 35 million board feet a year.
I don't believe that'll sustain an integrated wood products industry in Southeast Alaska. So what our focus is, we want to move forward with beginning to look at doing work in the second growth. And that's to do work like pre-commercial thinning, commercial thinning, help develop new markets for that type of biomass that can be removed from there, to help be able to find ways to diversify the economy and sustain an integrated wood products industry.
For instance, Tidwell sees potential in a new market for wood pellet-fired boilers. Tidwell said reasonably priced energy is another part of the transition plan.
To look where there's potentials for hydro, to look where there's potentials for energy from biomass. And if we can use some of the material that'll be removed from a commercial thin or a pre-commercial thin, some of that material will be able to be used for wood products. A lot of it will be used for biomass and, for instance, these boilers. Or a potential idea of a pellet plant would be a way to diversify the industry and actually create more jobs than what we currently have.
Tidwell highlighted Forest Service plans to provide what the agency calls long-term stewardship contracts on the Tongass and elsewhere in the country.
These are contracts that we would enter into with a mill owner or a contractor, that there'd be X amount of biomass that needs to be removed each year. There's X amount of restoration work that needs to be completed each year. And these are long-term contracts where the individual that has the contract, they would be guaranteed a certain amount of work as a minimum every year so that they could then invest in some additional infrastructure.
The Forest Service has not yet offered a long-term stewardship contract on the Tongass, according to public affairs staff with the Alaska region. The first such contract is expected to be offered at the beginning of next year. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Audubon Alaska has released a list of birds in trouble. The 2010 Audubon Watch List pinpoints 49 declining and vulnerable bird species in Alaska. Beth Peluso is Audubon Alaska's communications manager.
The idea is to try and keep an eye on them before they're in critical danger.
The list is an early warning system that calls attention to at-risk birds.
A lot of them do migrate, but there are some birds that stick around all year. Some of the surprises were lesser yellowlegs, which is a shorebird that has bright yellow legs that people can see pretty commonly around Alaska. They are declining, and even though they seem pretty numerous around here, there actually are some concerns about the numbers and the drop that's happening with them.
Peluso says factors outside Alaska influence the status of migrating birds. She says the list looks at the percentage of the global population of migrating birds, which occurs in Alaska, to determine the ranking. Some songbirds have made the list. Peluso says the local varied thrush stands out as a declining species, but there is no known reason why.
And some of these species, we don't know what's causing the declines yet. One of the ideas of the watch list is to give agencies and nonprofits and other groups and individuals that are interested in bird conservation a guideline for where to apply limited funding and limited time and resources for looking into which birds need more conservation help.
Matt Kirchhoff, Audubon Alaska's Director of Bird Conservation, says the information in the watch list is based on field surveys and reports by government agencies.
We talked to agency biologists that are involved in collecting this data. And what we basically do is organize it in a way and sort of systematically analyze it so that we can determine the relative priorities that different species should have. And hopefully this is useful to the agency people themselves in terms of setting their own research and management priorities.
Kirchhoff says the list is also useful to conservationists interested in evaluating the impacts of proposed development projects on bird species that may be vulnerable. The list has two categories. Red list species, 31 in all, are declining or depressed below recent historical levels, while yellow list species, there's 18 of them, are vulnerable species with small populations. The list contains some surprises. Kirchhoff says the dusky Canada goose, a subspecies of Canada goose, which exists in a localized area, is high on the list of vulnerable birds.
It's because of the earthquake that has changed the habitat there, and you've got trees and shrubs and stuff coming into what used to be their prime nesting habitat, and they're being exposed to increasing levels of predation.
Audubon Alaska's first watch list was released in 2002 with an update in 2005. This year's list highlights shorebirds, such as the lesser yellowlegs, which are in decline due to habitat degradation. A member of the Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council has been removed from the panel for publicly criticizing its decisions. Bob Shavelson, an outspoken environmental activist, says he believes the Oil Oversight Group has become a mouthpiece for government and industry. The council decided during a special executive session that Shavelson's negative comments about the council violate the nonprofit group's standards of conduct. Councilmember Robert Peterkin says Shavelson had been warned about speaking against decisions made by the board of directors. Peterkin says Shavelson is a good guy, but he was not following protocol.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The Alaska wildfire season is just about over. There are still 34 fires burning around the state, considered active, but none of them are being fought. Officials told the Fairbanks Daily News Miner that firefighters have been pulled off the last two fires that were being staffed, the Peavy Creek and Pat Creek fires northeast of Fairbanks. But crews remain on alert with hunting season in full swing and plenty of campfires around Alaska. The group that runs the World Ice Art Championships is pressing the Fairbanks Borough Assembly to push a land swap with the Alaska Railroad. Ice Alaska is facing a major lease hike for the railroad land where it runs the popular ice sculpture park each March and has proposed a trade of borough land for the ice park property and adjacent real estate along the Chena River. Ice Alaska and the railroad have long haggled over the lease, and negotiations between the borough and the railroad to hammer out a new arrangement have stalled. Ice Alaska Chairman Dick Brickley spoke to the Borough Assembly last week, telling members he wants them to make the land swap a priority.
We're willing to spend our own money to go and meet with every legislator to do this, to try to convince them that this is a good thing for our community. We're not all that we're asking from your body is to say that's where we want to go, or tell us of the other things what you would like to do so we can finally get closure on this.
The Assembly passed a resolution last February in support of a land swap and an Ice Alaska plan to expand. Brickley said the Winter Wonderland Park would accommodate more events over a long time frame.
Cross-country ski trails within the corridor, snow machining on the river, dog mushing on the river, Northern Lights viewing overhead. You can only let your imagination run wild by what we're actually talking about.
Brickley says the 2011 Ice Art Championships will happen, but it will be the last event in Fairbanks unless the land swap goes through. He says other local sites have been looked at, but they aren't ideal, and that the cost of moving buildings and other infrastructure is prohibitive. For Anchorage ski mountaineer Joe Stock, a good adventure has to involve lots of mystery. You can plan for weeks or months, but you never know what you're going to encounter. This spring, Stock set out with two friends for his first trip to the Wrangell Mountains. The idea was to explore deep into the glaciated mountains and ski fresh powder on high peaks, but it didn't take long for the elements to interfere with a different plan. Stock took along an audio recorder and has this first story in a two-part series.
We met our pilot Gary Green in McCarthy. He had long white hair, a cowboy hat, and leather jacket. Our adventure had already started.
How's it going?
Not bad.
Joe, good to meet you.
Yo, good to meet you.
I was traveling with two of my favorite adventure partners, Dylan Taylor and Danny Ullman. Both work full-time as mountain guides in Antarctica, South America, Europe, and Alaska. They have the two essential traits for trip partners. They are solid mountaineers and they are laid back. Gary landed us on a gravel airstrip at Skolai Pass at the east end of the Wrangell Mountains. We planned to ski west, into the Wrangells, as far as possible. Under monster packs, we walked across Skolai Pass, then skied on overflow ice along Middle Fork Creek. Dylan thought it looked more like Middle Earth.
I kind of feel like we're Frodo and Sam on the way into Mordor through this desolate brown wasteland of a landscape. Nothing looks alive, everything's just brown and just barely revealed after the winter snows blew away, and we have all these dark storm clouds in every horizon.
We camped among rock moraine rubble at the end of the Middle Fork Glacier. We were jittery with excitement and seeing new mountains, but also nursing some first day blisters.
Well, they feel kind of like roast beef.
Roast beef. Early the next morning, we were skiing on thin snow over glacier ice, gaining elevation. Exhaustion from the crippling packs timed with a ground blizzard had us camping below steep ice walls at the head of the glacier. Wind-driven snow pounded the tent all night. We knew that the wind, snow, and steep mountains formed dangerous avalanche conditions. The next day, we discussed our options for escaping the steep walled basin.
I think it was all ice wall the whole way. But I did see this ramp up at the head of the valley that looked like it might work. A little skinny ramp. It's much wider here on the map, but it looked like it might still go through. This one here.
Yeah, it's amazing. Looks like it goes. It just looks a little scary.
We talked for 2 hours and finally decided to climb toward the ridge. Soon we were stopped just above our previous camp, unable to move without triggering an avalanche that could bury us. We camped, frustrated. After letting the snow strengthen overnight, we tried again the next morning. We didn't make it far before avalanche conditions stopped us again. Then another hazard appeared, crevasses. Ahead, we saw easy snow ramps leading around ice cliffs. Avalanche slopes loomed above the ramps. We needed to ascend one of the ramps, yet stay beyond the runout of any avalanches. Dylan summed up our predicament.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to know which is the lesser of the two evils here. There's two options, and obviously if the fact that three of us are having this discussion means that none of them are perfect.
Yeah, we're all having doubts here.
As mountain guides, we thrive on tough decisions. Having three minds work together makes the decision-making process fun. We trust each other's opinions like our own. Start second-guessing your partner's decisions, and the trip fizzles out. We agreed to try the low-angle ramp to the right. Although riddled with crevasses, the ramp appeared to be beyond the runout of the loaded avalanche slopes above. Danny led the rope. He slowly zigzagged through the crevasses, giving the avalanche slope a wide berth. As we neared the pass,
we looked over and this huge crack just propagated or extended all the way across the slope, and all the snow beneath it broke loose and just flushed down the slope in a big powder cloud.
Danny had triggered an avalanche from hundreds of feet away. Luckily, we were out of harm's way. We continued until darkness, touring across the flat expanses of the Chishana Glacier in orange light, relieved to be making progress. In the tent that night, we pulled out the map and tried to figure out what to do. We wanted adventure, a trip with an unknown outcome. We also wanted to ski from mountaintops. The dangerous snow and avalanches were making that hard. Danny summed up what we all knew.
Well, I feel like the mountains have been giving us a lot of signs that say it's not the right time to be skiing here.
Do we keep fighting the crevasses and avalanches? Maybe we get lucky and continue without injury. Or do we head out of the mountains?
Anchorage Mountaineer Joe Stock continues the story of his Wrangell Mountain adventure tomorrow on Alaska News Nightly. To see a picture of the spectacular scenery on the trip, go to aprn.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. Follow us on Twitter at aprn. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Maria Dudzak in Ketchikan, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, and Joe Stock in the Wrangell Mountains. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a pre-existing medical condition, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the new temporary federal insurance program being administered by ACHIA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The program is for those with qualifying pre-existing conditions and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months. Talk to an independent insurance broker or go online to achia.com. This message sponsored by ACHIA Fed. The Federal Housing Administration's network of FHA-approved housing counseling agencies offers free expert advice to homeowners whose mortgages are at risk, underwater, or in need of refinancing. Visit hud.gov/Alaska for a counselor near you. This message sponsored by HUD.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.